ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, I'm Patricia Karvelis, host of Politics Now, the ABC's podcast unpacking the latest political news. Every week you'll hear me and the sharpest political minds at the ABC.
Ritual humiliation at which everybody laughs and pretends to be entertained by Donald Trump. That's on the Trump bingo card.
So join me for Politics Now on the ABC Listen app.
Well, Jez, it's very rare that you have a week like this in the country, in our city of Sydney that we both live in, let alone as a reporter trying to make sense of it all.
Absolutely. Jules, I was on air with the 7pm News in New South Wales when the story broke, and we heard just before we went on air, and you know, the disbelief that rippled through the newsroom because of the Martin Place siege, because of the stabbings at Bondi Junction.
Yes.
And when someone said an active shooter in Bondi, I said, we need to be absolutely sure before we publish anything. So we got it into the news bulletin. But as I was on air, I had friends who were having a Christmas party up the road. Mm. It's a Christmas party I normally go to every year. I knew they would be leaving about that same time. People very, very close to me. And I was terrified for them. I was terrified of what was happening in Bondi.
Mm.
And yet staying on air and knowing and seeing social media accounts publishing video of the terror that was unfolding there. And, you know, people described not knowing where the gunshots were coming from, where to run, how to keep safe, how to protect others. But what we've seen as well, Jules, is the absolute best of humanity, the stories that tell us who we are.
Yeah. And the fact that we saw those almost immediately has given us something to hold on to, I think. So you're at the desk, Jez, and where in the bulletin did you get, were you able to confirm it? So you're waiting for people to run around and verify all these facts before you can actually say it, and you're texting close friends.
Yeah. Verification is just so important at this time, right?
Yeah.
Because there were lots of rumours, lots of misinformation going around about multiple shooters, you know, possibly three or four, that there were other shootings taking place elsewhere in Sydney at the same time. So we were, you know, late to wear with it relative to TikTok and X and whatever.
Mm.
However,
mm.
we wanted to make absolutely sure that whatever we did publish was absolutely watertight. And then after I came off air, called a few people immediately and just said, are you okay? And heard stories of, you know, friends and family who were running, who had just missed the shooting unfold. And then I headed to St. Vincent's Hospital to report and to back up our reporter there and to help produce her. But it's one of those stories that, Jules, I'm sure you agree, it seems to me that everyone in Sydney is 2 degrees separated from the event. You either know someone who works at a hospital who was called in, or you were almost at the beach yourself, or you were there on the day. I know someone whose brother was killed. Everyone has been so touched by this.
Exactly. We've got a lot to unpack today, Jez.
I'm Jeremy Fernandez in Sydney on Gadigal land.
And I'm Julia Baird, and this is Not Stupid,
where we discuss the news in your feeds and the stuff that's grabbing our attention. Jules, there really has been one massive story of the week, not just for Australia, but around the world too.
And I don't know about you, but I've really felt that after something like this, people scramble so quickly for responses and answers and solutions. And sometimes we need a pause of grief and like solemnity and to be together.
I agree. I can understand the scramble for comfort and the containment of absolute fury. I totally get it.
Yeah.
Absolutely get it. As a journalist turning up to some of these live scenes, I kind of feel a bit guilty, to be honest, you know, rolling up in a suit and camera and microphone and feeling intrusive, but also my conviction lies with wanting and seeing the value in sharing the story and not making this an isolated incident, an isolated experience. This is something all of us should feel invested in.
Mm. so important to tell the story and every facet of it. And so today I think we really want to talk about what has been the response to it, what's been the political response, like what are the big debates, where is this kind of white hot anger coming from and what's it going to mean, and also where is the good that we've seen, what is the shape that it's taken.
So let's tackle the issue of gun reform first, yeah. Because this has been one of the key things that immediately our leaders came out and said there will be legislative reform.
Yeah.
Perhaps too early to go into detail about what that might be, but gun reform is something that most people are on the same page about.
Yeah.
We think of ourselves as having this gold standard.
Yes.
It's what we tell
the
world,
about
how
it.
The rest of the world describes us having this gold standard.
Because it was decisive, firm action.
Yeah.
There was a lot of pushback at the time.
Yeah.
If you hear the footage now of John Howard speaking at some rallies and getting booed and yelled at, he pushed through that opposition, and it was a genuine and really widely effective reform.
But the truth is we have more guns in Australia today than we did at Port Arthur, despite those reforms that were brought in. I remember doing some investigating for some reporting good 10 years ago and trying to get a handle on how many guns there were in Australia. It was nearly impossible because it was so different state by state, how it was administered, what the standards were for owning a gun, how long
what
the license was.
What reasons you can have one for.
The reasons you could have, and how many guns were actually issued, how many guns were out there. It was so difficult to tell.
But, I mean, we are now at the point where it's like, how did a man who's the father of someone that had been on ASIO's watch list have six guns as a registered firearm?
All of which were used in the attack.
All of which were all six.
All six, police say, were taken to the site of that shooting.
So I think there's a lot of questions about that. And now people are digging into gun ownership and going, hang on, there's someone in the urban area of Sydney who has 285 guns. How can you need that many guns? So the fact that there does seem to be some consensus around this, as discussed at the National Cabinet's meeting, that more needs to be done, that we need to look into it and tighten it, the reasons for it.
Can I just go into some of those numbers scale? Because this is really quite staggering. 4 million legally possessed guns in Australia, owned by just under a million people. On average, that's 4.3 firearms for each gun owner who's licensed to hold a weapon.
Can we point out as well, it was the semi-automatics that were banned in Port Arthur too, and it would have been significantly worse had the gunmen had access to those.
It is perfectly legal to own this many guns in all states and territories except for WA, which has recently brought in some new laws, and they've been hugely controversial. I want to talk a little bit about that because it gives us a picture of the national debate we're going to have around gun ownership in Australia.
Just before we get to that, can we just spell out just quickly for those people who are like, why would you need a gun? Who needs a gun? Why do you need a gun? The reasons are sports or competition target shooting. I mean, it varies a bit state by state, but it includes these recreational shooters or hunters and vermin control, primary producers who have to satisfy the licensing authority that there's a genuine need. There's an occupational requirement, security, collectors, heirlooms, and film and theatric armourers.
So there are legitimate reasons there, and no one is suggesting that no one in Australia anywhere should have a gun, right? Mm-hmm. This is not what's taking place. However, in WA, they have brought in some gun laws that are widely regarded to be the strictest in the country. They make it harder to get licences, including having a higher standard for the reasons for having a gun. There are limits on the numbers and types of firearms that can be owned. Hundreds of gun owners have protested over the course of many months. 1,000 people protesting outside Parliament House in Perth. One Nation, the WA Nationals, and the Legalised Cannabis MLC on the crossbench all supported a motion to scrap those laws. And critics say it's overreach, it's government control, and it impinges on cultural practice. And there were even videos circulated online showing AI-generated law enforcement officials. One of them shows them removing a gun from a crying elderly farmer, while the other shows an officer falsely stating that defence personnel cannot hold firearms unless they can prove they're not crazy. This is all created by AI, and it stokes the debate.
Right.
And I think this experience in WA is important for us in the rest of the country to foreshadow the sort of debate we're going to have nationally in talking about how gun law reform should be done.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's some really important provisions in there as well, right? They need mental health checks, you know, to be able to register as having a firearm. And they've also brought in that anyone who has a firearm now, that has been convicted of certain offences, including domestic violence, should have that firearm removed from them, which makes so much sense. The fact that you could possess a gun after having been convicted of domestic abuse, I think, is pretty problematic.
So a little bit of origin story.
Yeah.
Port Arthur, 1996, John Howard stepped in and implemented these major gun reforms. So the National Firearms Agreement established a uniform set of laws to be put in place right across Australia. And then there was the buyback program where more than 500,000 firearms were surrendered and destroyed, which is an enormous number. And to have politically that many people get on board with the idea that's not straightforward was really quite a remarkable achievement by John Howard.
Exactly. But now we have John Howard emerging after the Bondi shootings to say, yes, it was great. You know, he was too proud of what had happened after Port Arthur, pointing out that the semi-automatic weapons would have caused great harm. But he said he did not want a focus on gun law reform to be used as a pretext to avoid the broader debate about the spread of hatred of Jewish people and anti-Semitism. He said of the Prime Minister, his greatest failure is not to provide the moral leadership that a Prime Minister can in denouncing anti-Semitism. What you can say is that governments and individuals can do a lot to discourage the spread of prejudice, anti-Semitism, hatred of Jewish people, and I don't think the present federal government and the present Prime Minister have done enough in that area since 2023.
What do you think of that criticism? Because it does feel like a very difficult thing to navigate. So the government commissioned this report from the Anti-Semitism Envoy. It was specifically commissioned to look at ways to combat anti-Semitism. Now,
which has been markedly on the rise when we look at the incidents around the country in the last couple of years.
Yeah, no dispute about that.
Yep, we've seen firebombing, we've seen graffiti.
And so a lot of people in the Jewish community say this incident at Bondi has not come as a surprise. It was a question of where and when, not if.
Yes.
So a lot of people have been saying that the government hasn't done enough to respond to these acts of anti-Semitism. Yeah. Here's what it has done. It's banned Nazi symbols and strengthened hate crime laws. These were passed prior to the report's release. It's outlawed doxing after a number of Jewish creatives were basically had their personal details published online.
Which was pretty shocking, actually.
And it's created a national student ombudsman to deal with complaints in the tertiary education sector. We'll get to in just a moment.
There was a lot of focus in it on universities and saying that universities need a report card on how they're managing this, and also that there should be a media report as well to assess for balance.
And the criticism there, Jules, was that the Special Envoy said it would be up to them to work with the government on policing and enforcing some of these rules, which people have sort of described as a lack of separation of powers, right? There was a lack of independence there. That it shouldn't be up to the envoy to dictate and supervise the government's enforcement of things like immigration, university policy, areas of research, how broadcasters report and investigate issues around anti-Semitism, criticism of the Israeli government, for instance.
That's right. So, like, when this report came out, quite a few things implemented, not everything. Now there's discussion around should those things have been implemented, but there were questions about it. And people felt that there were shortcomings, again, structurally, who would have oversight and was this overreach in certain situations. Now it seems to be a blanket statement that the government hasn't done enough. Anthony Albanese on the back foot, and he has to keep like repeating again and again what he has actually done. I think that when we go back to the response to it and we hear that there's a white hot anger on the ground and in the Jewish community, without a doubt, there is a sense that more broadly, the threats against them have not been taken as seriously as they should have been for a couple of years. And that has mounted to a sense of unsafety. And for many, when this happened, not quite inevitability, but like this is what we said was going to happen.
And combine that with the intelligence failure when we now know that ASIO had the youngest shooter, I don't want to name him, the youngest shooter was known to have had links to an Islamic State terror cell in Sydney and had recently travelled to the Philippines with his father.
For almost a month.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there are really serious questions about it. But I think once we get through the kind of more a simpler discussion around the guns and the technicalities of that, we get to a really difficult discussion around what has happened in the way that Jewish people have been spoken about and threatened in the last couple of years within the context of people being critical of the conduct of the war in Gaza. And I think that is what we need to better understand. A couple of points here. Firstly, the question of safety. Like, I think it's clear that for a long time, Jewish people have been saying they don't really feel properly safe here. When things are doxed, when you dox, you know, people from a community who are regularly getting death threats, that's a very serious and potentially, you know, lethal thing to do. When we spoke about it on this podcast, when Daily Mail says, here's all the most, you know, powerful
Jewish people in the eastern suburbs of Sydney, yeah.
And by the way, this is kind of what they do. I mean, not very difficult to find out kind of where they are. Those things were treated with a great sense of kind of shock and alarm and fear.
There was some really good stuff in the Siegel report as well, right, about providing security, physical security mm-hmm. to Jewish communities, about regulating online platforms.
And there were only a couple of police officers at that event, which obviously in hindsight, but we need to know how those discussions were made as well and how those threats were weighed up. And we do know the New South Wales Premier Chris Minns has said, well, we would have done things differently now. Tez, I remember when I was in New York last year, I saw this play on Broadway. It's called The Prayer for the French Republic. Mm-hmm. It's about a French Jewish family and their struggle with their identity and rising anti-Semitism. And the play was kind of spliced between 1944, having people come back from war, and not everyone returned, obviously, from the concentration camps, and the rising bouts of anti-Semitism in 2016. And the whole premise of it is, who are we, where do we belong, and where are we most safe? And I was really struck by it then. Because it makes it so clear that this generational trauma is still very prescient and still very real. And I don't think that what a lot of people don't necessarily appreciate, that the Australian Jewish community has got a higher proportion of Holocaust survivors than any other country except for Israel.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. I didn't know that. I'm going to link to this piece from The New Yorker in our show notes. It's an interview with Michael Vizonte, who I used to work with at the Sydney Morning Herald, very thoughtful man who's the commissioning editor of the Jewish Independent. And he says that that fact is central to the identity and the ethos of the Jewish community in Australia, because it means that as generations have gone on, the sensibility and sensitivity within the community to the threats of anti-Semitism, prejudice, and any echoes of the Holocaust are much more pronounced here than they are virtually anywhere else. In America, there's a much more diverse array of Jews and affiliations. But in Australia, we are largely, he says, Holocaust survivor stock, and that's shaped our cultural and religious antenna very, very strongly. He says here, this also means the community leadership groups are very outspoken, pressing for more legal and regulatory responses to racial vilification and religious vilification. And he says there's been a history of even low-level incidents of anti-Semitism getting very strong responses from the Jewish community. And this sense we have to be very, very vigilant, because let's not forget what happened. He says that personally, as he felt growing up, like maybe this was a bit overstated, but that changed for him on October 7. And there was just this eruption of anti-Jewish, anti-Israeli sentiment. And it was kind of in all different kind of social levels. He talks about the incident on, you know, on October 9, the pro-Palestinian march, where people were saying, where are the Jews? He said, I've never even heard that expression, which sent a message of hostility and made people feel that they were a target. And then there were all the other kind of incidents that we've spoken about. Now, then he gets to what the crucial point, I think, is, Jez. So he talks about Benjamin Netanyahu immediately said to Anthony Albanese, this is your fault. He's been critical of him because he's recognised the Palestinian state, right? Which Malcolm Turnbull then pointed out and saying, Netanyahu, we don't want you in our politics. And actually, that's not an uncommon position globally. Michael Vizonte says, in terms of criticising the Israeli government, there's still a place for it and it needs to be done when it's appropriate. But it's become very difficult for people, certainly for Jewish people, to receive and digest legitimate criticism on its merit, because there's been so much toxic bile leveled at Jews and Israelis. It's become almost impossible to separate the arguments of legitimate criticism from the toxic messaging. So it's hard to see it as you know, legitimate criticism. And he says that's really one of the biggest casualties of what's happened. The Israeli government needs to be called out for its bad behaviour and policy and the things it says and does, but that criticism needs to be expressed in very precise terms. And even when that does happen, people kind of struggle to accept it. And I think that's really, and then he goes on to a discussion of, you know, how Zionism has been spoken about and the conflation with holding all Jews responsible for the actions of the state of Israel. And this was one of the criticisms of the Gillian Siegel report, was about its definition of anti-Semitism and would people be looped in together when they were saying, I don't agree with the conduct of the war in Gaza.
And it's worth noting that there are varying definitions, like a good couple of dozen definitions of what anti-Semitism is defined to be. Universities Australia has its own definition, which it says protects the right of academics to investigate and probe and challenge ideas around the state of Israel, Zionism, Jewish identity. There's the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, which has its own declaration, the Jerusalem Declaration on Anti-Semitism, which was created in response to that. Mm. The upshot is that there are varying definitions of what anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism mean.
And I do think a lot of people genuinely don't are yet to kind of fully grapple with it.
Yeah.
And I think that's interesting for Michael Vizonte, because he's saying there's been so much bile, it's hard for us to pass it out, right? Mm. And yet, how can we not have like a robust and honest discussion about the way a war is being conducted, about a level of civilian deaths, about
and
starvation?
And what that means for an Israeli state, right? What it means for a Jewish state.
Right.
For the right of Israel to exist.
Right.
Some of those definitions are directly tied to the very existence of Israel.
Yes.
And can't be separated in the definitions that are you know, kind of accepted by these various organisations.
That's right. I mean, Vizonte ends by saying, look, I think part of the issue in Australia is not just what they've done in terms of legislation and political leadership to protect Jews, but the messaging on the other side, because there's a considerable Muslim community who've been very concerned by Gaza, what the Israeli government and IDF have done. And so the government has been trying to acknowledge the pain and distress felt by Muslim and Palestinian communities and also acknowledge the insecurity and attacks visited on the Jewish community. And he says a lot of Jewish people interpret that as not being sufficiently protective. And, of course, Hamas is, you know, wrapped up in all of this as well. He said, look, that overall the government could have responded faster and more strongly. That's probably for other people to judge, Jez, but I think we can see quickly how fraught this is. And yet I think that question of the heritage of the Holocaust and the feeling of safety is one that's really important to acknowledge this week especially. And in reading through a lot of the accounts, so Reuven Morrison, who lost his life, he was the man who was throwing the bricks.
So you saw Ahmed Al-Ahmad disarming the elder shooter.
Yep.
And then there's another man who steps into that shot. I actually thought they were the same person because, you know, black trousers, white shirt.
Right.
Different people.
Yeah.
That was Reuven Morrison, who then steps in and is hurling bricks at the disarmed shooter.
Imagine.
Running towards that.
Massive gun and a brick.
Yeah.
That is real courage. Now, his story began in the former Soviet Union. He said, walking around the streets in the USSR, we always look back, we're aware of our environment and we expected the unexpected. This is a piece that he wrote for the ABC in December last year, almost exactly a year ago, saying we came here with the view that Australia is the safest country in the world and that Jews wouldn't be faced with such anti-Semitism in the future. But now, he said, that in 2024, a year ago, there's a feeling of being scared when you take your kids to kindergarten and to school. They don't know what kind of events can take place, that kind of vigilance. He says it's unpredictable.
That's no way to live, by the way. Like, just, you know, to have that hanging over your head constantly, 24 hours a day, and over the heads of your family when they, by necessity, leave the home to go to the shops, go to school, go to work.
Yeah.
What a thing to live with.
And another woman, Shavi, who threw her body over to protect a young girl, said that she's questioning her place in Australia and considering moving to Israel.
One of the most heartbreaking pieces of footage I saw this week was the father of that young girl, Matilda. They had moved here from Ukraine.
Yeah.
She was their firstborn Australian child, and they named her Matilda accordingly because she was their little Aussie baby and symbolised a new beginning for them. And the grief and disbelief is just, it's a lot to take in.
Jez, how do we patch the social cohesion here?
You know, one of the things I found really striking when I went down to Bondi to report at the scene of the memorial at Bondi Pavilion, which is only a, you know, like less than 100 metres away from the actual scene of the picnic where the people were targeted, was just the different backgrounds, the different faiths that were represented there, people sort of wanting to grieve together, and the absolute silence and respect that was shown to the Jewish community. Jewish people were at the centre of, are at the centre of that grieving. And there's a really lovely show of support and solidarity, people coming together. And I honestly think that everyone should go down and pay their respects if you can. Go down and experience it for yourself. I found it tremendously profound. I mean, I found myself on the verge of tears while I was broadcasting from down there because it was just so tremendously moving. And they were praying, they were singing hymns, and they were also celebrating the lives that were lost. And just to be in a community that knows it can't go back and take back what happened, but has the absolute power to determine what happens from here. These stories of heroism, the survival, the grace that's involved in celebrating the lives of those who were lost, I think tells us everything we wish about who we are. How we respond to tragedy, how we think about goodness, how we think about outreach, how we think about togetherness, protecting the safety of others, even if it means that it's got nothing to do with ourselves, but in reaching out and protecting others.
Yes, so we saw so many images on the day. We saw Ahmed El-Ahmed, who's now severely injured, wrestling one of the shooters to the ground in an act of courage that was very quickly kind of globally recognised because it was so stunning.
And then there was the married couple.
The married couple.
Boris and Sophia, who again took on one of the shooters.
Yep.
They were unfortunately killed. The lifeguards who ran barefoot towards the gunfire.
The lifeguards who went out and rescued people while the shooting was going on. And then there is the moments afterwards when a community comes together and looks after each other and supports each other. And you know, one thing I've been really heartened by was the number of people who went to give blood.
The queues have been phenomenal.
It was amazing. So I contacted Red Cross Blood yesterday to see how they were coping with the influx. And it was amazing story. She said they had 50,000 people contact them in one day, 14,000 new donors, an absolute record. This is Gemma Folgemeier, who I'd spoken to quite a bit for a book I wrote about grace and moral beauty and why people give blood in and how people come together after disasters. And she said that the donations yesterday were not seen in volume since the Black Saturday bushfires. Kindness crashed our website and call centre yesterday. People were waiting in lines of 6 hours or more. She goes, we were flooded with decency. She wants people to keep donating because the supplies overall need a boost anyway. She said the blood orders on Sunday night were terrifyingly large. They sent about 700 units.
Wow.
In the first 2 hours on Sunday night as events unfolded to about five hospitals. She told me about one story who was a mother from Maitland. She says she hasn't been well. She's been in hospital herself a lot this year, and her youngest son received transfusions around this time 10 years ago. And so she's got a real estate business which she uses to help women fleeing domestic violence. She helps find them accommodation. She shut up shop, closed the shop yesterday, walked down to Maitland Donor Centre, started making milkshakes for the donors, and was there for many hours. She can't donate herself for health reasons, but she got both of her sons on the donor beds not long after she arrived. And Gemma said to me, I found it extraordinary that she did this, but these were the kinds of people who turned out yesterday to help us.
And I think, Jules, that's our pick of the week.
Yeah.
All those people. I don't know, how do you feel? Like, I just feel so sorry. I feel so sorry.
I feel gutted.
But they tell us who we are, who we wish to be, who we should be. they raise the standard, give us an example. And I think that is the shining light in this terrible grief that I think will guide us through the many challenges we've got in front of us right now.
I think that's exactly right. Thanks for your reporting on this, Jez. It's a tough week.
It's a lot for all of us, I think.
Yeah.
Not a single person's been left untouched.
Exactly. I hope people keep donating blood as well. I'll talk to you next week.
See you then, darling.
Lots of love.
Bye.